This is Phil Ferrand, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today, and I don't think I'm coming in tomorrow, because I think we've got everything under control. We will find out tomorrow whether that's true. But at the moment, everything is puttering along. It's been a good week. Made some good progress. I'm working on a design for the second project in this big initiative I'm working on. The development is puttering along on the first little project as part of that initiative. So that's all going well. Got to get the design together on this second piece of it, and there's actually two pieces inside that one. So had some good meetings this week, had some good discussions, and I'm building a little prototype at this point, and once I get that little prototype built, then I can go ahead and actually start building the design documents and then get the presentation together. I would imagine, I got a couple of more, two or three more weeks of work to do to get that all together, but all in all, everything seems to be puttering along, and we are okay. So that's good. I'm doing, hopefully, the final read-through this weekend on Windfall, the 99-1. I think I'm going to make that, unless there's some big thing that happens this weekend. But the book is 360 pages or so. Actually, it's 400 in manuscript. It is 400 in manuscript. Okay, I have a little more reading than I remembered, but that's okay. I'll probably be able to get it done this weekend. My goal is to get that read this weekend. My wife is actually out. She's in Oklahoma. Her brother is becoming the battalion commander at a Army Reserve thing. And so she went down to see him do the ceremony where he gets to take over for that. So she wanted to go down for that. It's basically me. I'm going home. I'm reading like crazy. So I've got this evening, and I've got Friday, I've got Saturday, and I've got Sunday. And I'm just going to try to plow through this, get it read. Then next week, I have to tweak the cover, got to relay out the book again with all the changes and stuff. And then once I get that done, submit the proof, get the proof ordered, blah, 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 get the Kindle version up, and get the EPUB version up, and I'm actually not going to do an iBook version this time, and then if I get all that done, then, I'll be in good shape. So I'm hoping by the end of next week to have all that stuff up, and then I can get back to Windfall Broadcast. But it's been good to have a little break from Windfall Broadcast, because it's given me a chance to kind of step back and think about things a little bit, and think about what I need to do in terms of polishing atmosphere a little bit on Windfall Broadcast. And so then it's just going to be a dead run. I did kind of think my way through this morning. I was thinking, okay, so if I get this book done by the end of this month, Windfall the 99-1, that means it'll take me about 7 months, hopefully, to write one of these books. If I can get it done in 7 months, and even if I only work 11 months out of the year, so I, factor in an anniversary vacation, factor in taking a couple of weeks off at Christmas, or taking a week off at Christmas, which I probably won't, but, even factor in that, if I'm only working 11 months a year, it means that when I retire in 10 years and 10 months, which is about 120 months. It takes me 7 months per. I should be finished with the 17th book by the time I retire, and there will only be 7 more to go. This is crazy. This is nuts. There'll only be 7 more to go, which at that point, once I retire, I should be able to get at least 2 done a year, if not 2.5 done a year. So I should be able to get the series finished up in like another 3 years, which means I should have this series done by the time I turn 70. This is nuts. But you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained. So, there you go. What else? Had some nice conversations with friends this week. Excuse me. Just all in all, it's been a good week. I have been ticking off bookmarks on a lot of different things over the last couple of weeks. Things that I thought, oh, that might be interesting to talk about. I went through a bunch of them last night, and they just weren't that interesting. Weren't as interesting as I thought on first glance. Or maybe I should say that they appeared to have far more effort involved to get them to the point that they would be interesting than I wanted to put into them. So because of that, I ended up with something that was just a week or two ago, I think I came across this, and I read through it, and I felt like the guy had a really good, balanced, level-headed viewpoint. And I thought, yeah, I should talk about this, because I agree with what he's saying. The man's name was Sam Harris, who I was not familiar with. His blog that he had put out was called Why I Don't Criticize Israel. And apparently he did it as an audio transcript at first. And then, there were several people, and apparently it went viral. And then there were several people. He has a big following to begin with, I guess. So, you know, it's not like me where I have 2 or 3 people that listen to this. Apparently it had gone viral, and there were people that had criticized him about certain points because they didn't really listen to what he was saying. Imagine that. And so he had put out a written transcript of it, and then also he'd put in some explanatory notes on that. And so this was that written transcript plus more of his explanatory notes. But I think he has some good observations to make about the situation with Israel and with the Arabic nations and, you know, what our relationship should be. He starts off just talking about some statistics about where we're at. He said at this moment there are something like 15 million Jews on earth, and there are 100 times that many Muslims. And he said one of the interesting things that he finds about Judaism is that in his lectures, when he's been talking, he has debated rabbis at times when he has assumed that they have believed in a God that can hear our prayers. And he said they have stopped him to say, why would you think that I believe in a God who can hear prayers? And he said what's interesting about Judaism is you actually have rabbis, conservative rabbis, who believe in God, in a God so elastic as to exclude every concrete claim about him, and the demands that people normally in religion make on their gods. And he said, beyond that, you literally have millions of Jews for whom Judaism is very important, and yet they're atheists. He said, they don't believe in a God at all. And he said, within Judaism, this is actually a position you can hold, which would be a complete non sequitur in terms of Islam or Christianity. He said, so when you're talking about Jews and Judaism and irrational beliefs about scriptures, he said, honestly, the Jewish religion seemed to have the least offenders. He said, there are certainly some people who are on the extremes. He said, but they're far fewer because Judaism is so elastic in what it allows. And in his words, he said, it's simply a fact that most Jews and most Israelis are not guided by their scriptures. And he claims that that's a good thing. So, you know, if people were truly guided by the scriptures, the things that Jesus, well, let me put it this way, if they were truly guided by the things that Jesus said, it would be a good thing. But unfortunately, what happens in organized religion is we listen to what Jesus says, and then we reinterpret it into something that he doesn't say at all because we're too concerned about our own survival. That's a sidebar. Anyways, he does go on to say, that doesn't mean that I don't say things that are critical about Israel. He said when he made this talk, he had people saying, well, why aren't you criticizing Israel as much? And, you know, he's basically, those people aren't listening, haven't been listening to what I've said, and they didn't even listen to the talk really well, because he said, I am critical of things that Israel is doing. He said, there's no question, he said, that I don't think Israel should exist as a Jewish state. In his words, he thinks it's obscene, irrational, and unjustifiable to have a state that's organized around religion. So he doesn't celebrate the idea that there's a Jewish homeland in the Middle East. And he said he certainly doesn't support any Jewish claims to real estate based on the Bible. He said, on the other hand, he said, if we were going to say that any particular people should have a state that's dedicated just to them, he would say probably the Jews deserve it more than anything else, because he said we don't really need to look any further than the fact that the rest of the world has shown itself eager to murder the Jews at every opportunity, which is true. He said, however, in defending its territory as a Jewish state, he said, the Israeli government has had to do some terrible things. He said, there's no question about that. They have fought against Palestinians, and they've caused massive losses of innocent lives. And he said, there's no question in his mind that some of the things that the Jews have, that the Jewish state has done, the Israeli government has done, is tantamount to war crimes. But he said, this whole process of trying to defend their very existence, they have been brutalized by this process, that is, made brutal by it. And he said that, in large part, is due to the character of their enemies. He put a little something in here. He says, note, said, I was not giving Israel a pass to commit war crimes. He said, I'm making a point about the realities of living under a continuous threat of terrorism, and of fighting wars, multiple wars, in a confined space. Okay, well, that's true. He said, it's also true that Israel has been under worldwide public scrutiny more than any other societies has had to be when defending itself against aggressors. He said, the Israelis are simply held to different standards. And he said, you know, Israel has been losing its PR war for some time. And, you know, that's true. He said one of the big problems, things that's a problem for outside observers, is the appallingly disproportionate loss of life on the Palestinian side. It just doesn't, when people just look at the numbers, said obviously it doesn't make sense that there are so many casualties on the Palestinian side and so few on the Israeli side. But he did make a good point when he said, if you look at the history of what's been going on, he said Israelis have been building bomb shelters to protect their citizens. He said while the Palestinians have built tunnels through which they could carry out terrorist attacks and kidnap Israelis. So he said, you know, he's not really sure that Israel should be blamed for successfully protecting its population in a defensive war. He said, but there's no way to look at the images that are coming out of Gaza, especially with respect to infants and toddlers that are riddled by shrapnel, than to say anything else than this is a monstrous evil. You know, and he said, inasmuch as the Israelis are the ones who are doing this, it seems, in my terminology, at first glance, impossible to be able to support them. He said, there's no question that the Palestinians have suffered terribly for decades under occupation. And he said, this seems to be another spot where most critics of Israel appear to be stuck. They see those images, and they see the occupation, and they blame Israel for making Gaza a concentration camp. Okay. Well, those are all bad things, but the guy goes on to say he sees this as a kind of moral illusion born of the failure to look at the actual causes of the conflict, as well as a failure to understand the intentions of the people on either side of it. And this is where it gets interesting. This is where, because I thought the whole setup, you know, I was like, well, yeah, okay, guy's making a lot of points. But when he got to this spot, I thought, oh, you know, what he's saying is really true. And he says, but the truth of all this is, if you really look at it, that there is, in his words, an obvious, undeniable, and hugely consequential moral difference between Israel's and her enemies. And he said, the Israelis are surrounded by people who have explicitly genocidal intentions towards them. He said, the chapter of Hamas is explicitly genocidal. It looks forward to a time based on Quranic prophecy when the earth itself will cry out for Jewish blood, when the stones and the trees will say, O Muslim, there is a Jew hiding behind me. Come and kill him. He said, this is a political document. We are talking about a government that was voted into power by the majority of Palestinians. And he said, yeah, I know that not every Palestinian supports Hamas, but enough do that they were brought to power in Gaza. And he said, there is also discourse in the Muslim world about Jews that is utterly shocking. Said, not only is there Holocaust denial, there's Holocaust denial that then asserts to do it for real if we had a chance. So not only do the Palestinians deny that the Holocaust happened, which was an attempt to wipe out the Jews, they are also turning around and saying, well, even though that didn't happen, if we get the chance, We're going to make it happen. He said there are children's shows in the Palestinian territories and elsewhere that teach five-year-olds about the glories of martyrdom and about the necessity of killing Jews. All right. So in his words, this gets down to this moral difference between Israel and her enemies. And he said it's really illustrated by a simple question. What would each side do if they had the power to do whatever they wanted? And he said, for instance, what would the Jews do to the Palestinians if they could do anything they wanted? He said, well, we know the answer to that question because they can do more or less anything they want. They have the firepower to do it. He said, if the Israelis wanted to, they could kill everyone in Gaza tomorrow. So what does that mean? Well, it means that when they drop a bomb on a beach and kill four Palestinian children, as happened last week, then it's most certainly an accident. They weren't targeting the children. They could target as many children as they want to. Every time a Palestinian child dies, Israel edges ever closer to becoming an international pariah, but Israel takes great pains not to kill children and other combatants. So even though Israel has the capability to wipe out the Palestinians, they really make an effort not to do that. Now then, if you flip that equation around and say, what would the Palestinians do? Or maybe Hamas, what would the majority of Palestinians, what would they do? What would they vote for? I'm getting my mail, one moment. If they had a chance to do whatever they wanted to do, the outcome would be very different. One moment. 17th annual Blues Masters at the Crossroads. Oh, interesting. Just check down below here to see. Okay, good. So he says, what do we know of the Palestinians? And what would the Palestinians do if they had the power to do anything they wanted, if the power was on their side? And he says, well, they've told us what they would do. And he said, for some reason, the critics of Israel don't want to believe the worst about a group like Hamas, even when it declares the worst of itself, even when it makes the statements about what they would do. From everything Hamas has told us, he says there is every reason to believe that the Palestinians would kill all of the Jews in Israel if they had the chance. I'm backing into my garage, one moment. Try not to run into anything. There we go. And he said, so, okay, is every Palestinian going to support genocide? And he said, well, no. He said, but there are vast numbers of them and of Muslims throughout the world who would. Needless to say, the Palestinians in general, not just Hamas, have a history of targeting innocent non-combatants in the most shocking ways possible. They've blown themselves up in buses and restaurants. They've massacred teenagers. They've murdered Olympic athletes. They now shoot rockets indiscriminately into civilian areas. And again, the charter of their government in Gaza explicitly tells us that they want to annihilate the Jews, not just in Israel, but everywhere. The other thing that he brings up, which is a very interesting point, he said, you know, the truth is that everything you need to know about the moral imbalance between Israel and her enemies can be understood with the topic of human shields. He said, who uses human shields? He said, well, Hamas certainly does. They shoot their rockets from residential neighborhoods, you know, from schools, from hospitals, from mosques. Muslims in other recent conflicts in Iraq and elsewhere have also used human shields. They have laid their rifles on the shoulders of their own children and shot from behind their bodies. He said, consider the moral difference between using human shields and being deterred by them. This is the difference we're talking about. Israel and other Western powers are deterred, however imperfectly, by the Muslim use of human shields in these conflicts, as we should be. It is morally abhorrent to kill non-combatants if you can avoid it. He said, but this was where it gets into it. Take a moment to reflect on how contemptible this behavior is and understand how cynical it is. The Muslims are acting on the assumption, the knowledge, in fact, that the infidels with whom they fight, the very people whom their religion does nothing but vilify, will be deterred by their use of Muslim human shields. And yet they consider the Jews the spawn of apes and pigs, and yet they rely on the fact that these apes and pigs don't want to kill Muslim non-combatants. He said, now just imagine for a minute if these roles were reversed. What do you think would happen if Israeli soldiers tried to hide behind Israeli children or Israeli women? He said, you know, what would happen? He said, there's a reason that that's ridiculous, because the Palestinians are trying to kill everyone. Killing women and children is just part of the plan. Reversing the roles here produces a grotesque Monty Python skit. So, okay. So that's very, very interesting. He said, the truth of it is this isn't even the worst that jihadists do using human shields. Hamas is practically a moderate organization compared to other jihadist groups. He said, there are Muslims who have blown themselves up in crowds of children, again, Muslim children, just to get at American soldiers who were handing out candy to them. They have committed suicide bombings, only to send another bomber to the hospital to await the casualties, where they then blow up all the injured along with the doctors and nurses who are trying to save them. Okay, these are things that are actually being done. You know, so I think the guy has a lot of really interesting points and a very clear way of thinking about this in terms of, great, so if each side had the power to do whatever they wanted, what would they do? And this business of human shields, how is that being used? And, you know, what other, well, there's another story I want to tell you. Let me just finish up with him real quick, and then I'll tell you another story that says. So he says, again, you have to ask yourself, what do these groups want? What would they accomplish if they could accomplish anything? What would the Israelis do if they could do what they want? They would live in peace with their neighbors if they had neighbors who would live in peace with them. They would simply continue to build out their high-tech sector and thrive. What would groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda and even Hamas want? They would want to impose their religious views on the rest of humanity. They would want to stifle every religious freedom that decent, educated, secular people care about. This is not a trivial difference, and yet judging from the level of condemnation that Israel now receives, you would think that the difference ran the other way, which I think that's an excellent point. I was watching another little video that was just fascinating to me, and I got to wrap this up because I got things to do. Fascinating to me. There was a Jewish lecturer who was at a college, and he was answering questions, and there was the leader of the Muslim Student Association, MSA, that she came up and she asked a question, and she said, Honestly, you've made claims that the MSA organizations around the United States support terrorism. And she said, I would like to know what organizations those are, she said, because we're always scrambling for funds. She said, we're always trying to get grants, and it's very difficult. So it would be great if we actually got some support, but we don't ever get any support from them. And the Jewish lecturer looked at her and he said, I'll just ask you one question. He said, will you renounce Hamas right here in front of us? Will you say that what Hamas says is wrong? And she said, I'm not going to do that. And he said, well, why not? She said, because I'm not going to crucify him. I'm not going to be crucified. And he, you know, talked to her a little bit more. And then she kind of explained a little bit. She said, if I came out and said that I supported Hamas, she said, I might be put on a terrorist watch list. So, of course, I'm not going to say that. And he said, all right. He said, well, then let me ask you another question. He said, so-and-so person, high-ranking somebody in some Muslim organization, has said publicly, I really wish that all of the Jews in the world would all move to Israel so that they would be in one place so that we could kill them all. And he said, are you for that statement or against it? And he waited, and she thought for a minute, and she looked at him, and then she leaned into the microphone and said, for it, and then walked away. So, you know, I know it's not necessarily the politically correct thing to say that Islam is fundamentally a different type of religion, but, you know, when I was doing Still Whispers and I was looking around for quotes in a chapter, and I've mentioned this before, in a chapter called Truth Bubbles, and I was trying to find some quote out of the Quran where I could say, see, this shows the flesh and the spirit and God is working and God is talking to people and, you know, this, you know, is similar. And I used quotes from, was it Navajo? I can't remember. Some American, not American, Indian, Native American, whatever we want to say, culture. I used quotes from Buddhism, Hinduism. I think some secular quotes about this idea of this struggle between flesh and spirit. I looked for famous quotes from the Quran, trying to find something I could use, and I never could find anything. What I did find is an offshoot, the Sufis that are the mystic Islams, they had a lot of their stuff together. And it was like, yeah, I hear Jesus there. But from standard Islam, I couldn't find anything. Because as Bill Maher, I was watching Bill Maher. And Bill Maher did this stunning interview with Charlie Rhodes. You can look it up on YouTube, that he was just saying, you know, look, Islam is different. He said, you can't find another religion. He said, and Charlie Rose was saying, well, there are radicals in Christianity as well. He said, yes, there are radicals in Christianity as well. He said, but the majority of Christians do not believe that if you commit adultery, you should be beheaded. The majority of Christians do not believe that if you draw a picture of Jesus, that you deserve to die. The majority of Christians do not believe that if you leave Christianity, that you should be killed. And he said, and this is what the majority of Muslims believe, which is true. So it's very interesting, and it's going to be very interesting to see what happens with ISIS, and it's going to be very interesting to see how the world responds to this. And I understand that the people who are in ISIS, they're just nuts. I understand that. But there does seem to be something different. And I could tell you other stories, interesting things about anecdotes that I've heard. There does seem to be something different about Islam. And it's going to be very interesting to me to see how this big cultural difference is going to play out in the future. Because this whole ISIS thing just completely came out of the blue. I mean, for me at least, it was like everything was kind of set, and then suddenly they're taking vast swaths of land. It's fascinating. It's a fascinating, fascinating thing. So, you know, the future is coming. As I'm fond of saying, there is nothing to fear, but there's a whole bunch to be fascinated about. This is Phil Farron, and I have made it home.